Welcome to the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including moose tipping. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa.
And we're very excited to be joined by a special guest. It's Olivia Lothery. Welcome.
It's me. Hi. thank you for letting me be on this episode and talking about my favorite game in the entire world.
Excellent, excellent. Well, when we started to cover another Uwe Rosenberg game, obviously the first thought was, who is into Uwe Rosenberg? And my mind immediately went to your tattoo. So yeah. It's safe to assume you're a fan.
Yeah.
And I know that you're also into sort of miniature wargaming, which is something Mark's been talking a little bit about. Obviously, an underrepresented part of the Omni Gamer spectrum here. So excited to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, huge into mostly skirmish games, but everything miniatures right now. It's been my focus lately. So Uwe's kind of taken a back seat for a little bit while I focus on that.
Uwe will always be there in our hearts, right?
Yeah.
And on your skin.
And on my body. Yeah, yeah. I'm very excited to someday go to Essen so that I can show him, because I'm told that he's been there a fair amount, obviously. Mm. And I really want to get a picture of him and just be like, I've got your face tattooed on my body. Thank you.
Wow. That may be a first. I'm sure he'll be excited.
I think I pulled it directly from the Feast for Odin rule book as well, because it's one of his, it's that very classical Uwe illustration of him, like, just in case
did you know something.
Yep.
I like to think of that as the actually pose. It's like, you failed this very important rule here. Classic gamer. That's so cool. Yeah, I would actually like to hear a little bit more about your gaming background, if you wouldn't mind, Olivia. So wargaming is, like, I'm a bit of a poser. I'm sorry. I'm really just getting into it. And I'm super excited to learn about more skirmish games. You know, I know their names, but I haven't played very much. And I think you have a game you wrote down on your notes that I'm very curious about. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's two that I kind of wanted to touch on. One that I'm learning right now that just released called Nightthirst. This one is a vampire miniatures battle royale game, but it can be played for 2 to 6 players, so not necessarily just like skirmish with just 2 people. This one was designed by Whittle Goblin, aka Witty. And we love seeing more women in this space getting to design games. So I love that. But it's a miniature game played on like a 3x3 grid. It's got pre-selected scenarios. You can choose different vampire archetypes to play, and you're hunting victims in it. I haven't actually seen a ton of, there's vampires in like Games Workshop's games. So like your Warhammer, Age of Sigmar. We've got vampires.
Space vampires.
essentially, yeah. It's definitely just like you're just playing as a vampire. You can bite people and things like that. But this one definitely feels more like they're leaning into the trope of it all. So I'm always on the lookout for like unique battle royale or PvP minis games. And the studio that produced it, Blacksite Studio, they do a lot of indie games, which I really, really like. A lot of opportunities for like small box type games as well. So it's not like you need to show up and buy a ton of their miniatures. They do a lot of what they call minis agnostic games. So if you've already got minis, you can just bring those in to play their games. You don't necessarily need to buy their specific box for it. So that one I'm learning. I can't speak too much on it right now because it did just get released, but I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I hadn't seen much of that yet, other from the design and artwork for it. It looked had a very sort of 70s pulp look to it, digging into some classic vibes there. So excited to check that out. Mark and I have been talking a little bit about sort of other minis agnostic games. Like I just got a notification that my copy of 5 Parsecs from Home, the sort of sci-fi skirmish tactics game, came in. So that's exciting. I think was it Blacksite that also, there was another sci-fi game I remember you discussing. Was that from the same publisher?
Yeah. Same that one. Like so one, that one's
like this little square grid of what was the name of that game?
So that one's called Demon Ship. And that one's by Malev. Yeah. So that one, oh my God. And it's a solo minis game. Which that was my first tip into solo minis games. So everything kind of fit into that MDF box that he created. And so you could move around the pieces and put your miniatures in that. But yeah, that one was definitely sci-fi. You're shooting aliens. You're trying to escape a spaceship. Fantastic.
Very cool little modular terrain. You could move around on this small grid to create sort of different permutations of a map. It was a very cool system, it looked like. I mean to track that down.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. No, that one also sounds fantastic.
Really exciting. Yeah. That sounds so great. Yeah. I got, I've just started getting into minis games. I haven't even hardly been playing, although I do have a neighbor who's willing to play. Daniel's also into it. I've mostly just been starting to learn how to paint, which has been a slow but enjoyable process. And I got some material from, I think it's called Battle Systems. They're a UK company, and they are most known for their terrain. So you might have seen it. They do mostly sci-fi that I've seen, but they've started to do fantasy, basically like snap fit paper craft. So like you got space stations and alien infested ships and edge of the galaxy type rough camps and things like that. So I'm really excited to put that to the fore. Maybe I'll be able to try that out with Demon Ship or definitely with 5 Parsecs. So I'm excited to learn a lot more.
Another company that I really like is Tinker House. They have similar like fitted, I don't want to call it cardboard, but it is like printed on a foam almost, pre-printed. Oh, nice. And you can get like the industrial, you can get kind of a sci-fi look. I really like that you don't necessarily have to go all in on plastic. If you don't want to, you can take different routes.
Yeah, it's great to see some more sustainable options without just filling your house with plastic and like reusing terrain for multiple different games and systems. So it's a very scrappy side of the hobby.
Yeah,
and just storage, right? Like if you have piles of plastic, you need piles of space to store all that piles of plastic. So anything that can lie flat sounds great to me.
Yeah.
Flat pack, all that stuff, just like IKEA. Very cool. Tell us any other games that have you excited, Olivia. I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, so the other one that I'm waiting for, I think it is literally releasing maybe 9 hours from now, but will be at Gen Con, is called Warcrow. This one's produced by, I believe they are an Italian publisher, Corvus Belli. And they're pretty known for not like necessarily citing the specific designers because they've got a team that works on there. But there is a woman that works on the Warcrow design, which I was very excited about. This one is a medieval fantasy miniatures war game, Skirmish. This one I find to be very inclusive. The dwarves that they've got in their races have men and women, and across the board, like you've got some that are like bearded, almost femme style miniatures, which I think is really neat. But another thing that's like scenario-based skirmishes, quick to play and easy to learn. Everything that you need is in that like battle box. So you've got miniatures, a gaming mat, rules, templates, etc. And then the constructions of the minis are, I think, very easy to work with. If you're used to like Warhammer, they come on sprues that you need to like snip off and everything. That I find to be more of like a higher level miniatures. It's just harder to do. These are all like pre-printed plastic that have almost like a square-shaped groove that you just glue together. Very, very easy. You know, if you want to pick up a minis game for the first time, I would suggest this one to be it. The rules are pretty straightforward. A lot of dice rolling again, but very easy. So if you're at Gen Con, I suggest checking that one out.
No, cool. That's so exciting. I am super jealous. I have this anecdote that a couple years ago, Daniel helps run this smaller con in town called Terminal City Tabletop Convention. And I was there at the previous venue. And there's like a used game sale that goes on there for the duration of the con. And there was a complete set of Aristia, which is a Corvus Belli as well. It's like a combat game show themed skirmish game, which I just like, I devoured the rules for that. It looks so cool. It's like kind of hero shooter themed, and I think you pit like four heroes against four heroes.
Kind of like the Running Man or something, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. Like, or American Gladiators or something, it's a combat game. And like, there's giant pandas, and then there's like, you know, Overwatch style. There's like, what's their face? Basically everyone's a character, and they have outlandish designs. Yep. And I liked how kind of board gamey it is. Like, everyone has these like power cards and things that you play, and there's literal hand management and stuff like that. So really innovative stuff. I like what Corvus Belli does from a distance. Mm-hmm. And are they also responsible for Infinity, or is that someone else?
I think so. I only just recently got introduced to them from a friend at Adepticon, which is like a pretty big, or like, it's not big, but like, it is the main miniatures game con. Yeah, it's very tiny when you show up, but then it's like, no, we're all just here to play miniatures. Cool. they seem to have very intuitive systems that they're creating, and they want it to be something that you can step in as a beginner, but also if you've been in the scene already, there's some depth to it that you can add. So I do like them.
Yeah, well, war games can definitely be a little intimidating, both in the monetary investment to get like a full army of Warhammer, for example, but also just the rules overhead. So it's great to see some more accessible sort of gateway games into that hobby.
Awesome. Anything else exciting you've been playing, Olivia?
I've been playing a lot of things lately. It's been so hot that like I'm all I can do is play games. But yeah, those are the two main ones. I've been working on playtesting the solo edition of Keystone North America, their second edition. Ooh, of this.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Very nice. And Rose Gauntlet. Got their Coastal expansion. Yep, that one's by Rose Gauntlet Entertainment. And then that one's designed by Jeffrey Joyce and Isaac Vega. Oh, they're just fantastic. Everything they put out, I'm like deeply invested in. Working on this solo campaign has been lovely. They go very deep in their narratives. The second scenario made me cry immediately, like a happy cry, but it made me cry. And so I'm like, I'm fully into this. But the game itself is very like brain burner. It's like a puzzled pattern building game. You're taking on the role of like being a biologist, building an interconnected ecosystem. And you're doing that through like card placement. Can be very soothing as a solo player, which I've been leaning more on lately.
Yeah, I have the solo journal for the first edition of that around here somewhere. And it's like my favorite style of solo game that has very clear win-loss conditions.
Yes.
Just enough story to get you hooked. And it's not just chase the high score. It gives you a framework to have specific goals. And I think it's like 30 or something scenarios in there. I backed the second edition. So very excited to see how that solo mode is being revamped as well.
Let me know how you feel about the second scenario, because I would just like everyone to cry with me, which is beautiful.
That's so great. Yeah, Daniel and I have had the privilege to help playtest a little bit in our time. I think we participated in, I did some playtesting for the Dim Sum game Steam Up with our local designers, Hot Banana Game, who are fantastic. We're working with Quinn Brander on his forthcoming, it's rebuilding Chicago this time. Is that right? The last one was rebuilding Seattle.
Yes, I think so. I think Chicago, yeah.
I think and that's what I saw as well, because I've been following Quinn a lot lately, and fantastic designer.
Right. Although it wasn't rebuilding Chicago that he was working on. It was a new game that we're excited to see, more narrative story driven, which is, I was reminded about what you were saying about the narrative side. And then I think we also playtested even like Cascadia, right? You and I were on a
game. I didn't know, but you may have.
Okay. But just fantastic opportunities. Just want to shout out, if anyone's watching on the publishing side or the design side, we'd be happy to try out your game potentially.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of publishers have fun. Like on their Discord, they're always asking for like people to come in and play test games. So if that's something anyone's interested in, like a lot of publishers are always looking for more help on that side of things. I know Rose Gauntlet have regularly. I think I did some early playtesting for Keystone North America. Now that I think of it, they didn't get enough time to sort of online. Obviously, wasn't able to do a lot of plays, but I know they are open to that. So it's exciting to see games evolve over the course of development.
Yeah, I've done lot of playtesting, and I did playtesting for their newest game that's coming out in like a week or a month maybe, for Wild Gardens.
Ooh, yes, yes, I'm very excited for that.
And I did solo playtesting for that one too. And again, I mean, like, I really don't like working with like automas or anything with solo play. It takes up too much time. And so there's very much, like you had said, it's a lot of just like, you're not necessarily just chasing the highest goal, but you're trying to meet certain goals throughout it. And Wild Gardens was a lot like that. But yeah, playtesting is a really wonderful way to connect with publishers, and actually, I don't know, feel like you're part of the process. A lot of the times they're in constant need of playtesters. So I love connecting folks with other publishers to keep working on that.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's so great. If anyone's listening just as a fan or wants to get into the game design industry or even just play a part, it is a lot of fun, and you build good relationships with the publishers. They tend to appreciate any help you get. Of course, it's always nice to see your name in a rule book once it gets published in final form too.
And then even it's not just publishers, it's often like a lot of cities have their sort of a game design sort of group. Like, we have Vancouver Playtesters here, which is just independent people showing the games to each other, basically, and giving each other advice. So a lot of cities will have groups like that you can jump into and help some sort of local designers workshop their game.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the lifeblood of our industry. So go out and help your local designer if you can. Awesome. Well, I think I could talk about the games you're into, Olivia, all day, but I think maybe we should roll into the main event, if that's all right.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. So, of course, we're talking about A Feast for Odin. We already established that it's designer Uwe Rosenberg, but Olivia, maybe can you tell us a little bit about your kind of history with Uwe games? You love them. So, what's been your journey?
The Uwe oeuvre.
Oeuvre, exactly.
Yeah. Very early on into the hobby, I had learned Caverna, and that was kind of my first big box Uwe game. Instant love. It was just an instant... I really enjoy how it is very much like a solitaire experience, where it is you working on your board that other players might affect, but not very aggressively. It's mostly just a chill game of farming and feeding people, and I really enjoyed that. So that one stood out to me, and I don't remember how long it was until Feast was announced, but the moment that it was announced, I pre-ordered it. I saw Vikings, love Vikings, saw a big box. Specifically with this one, we're doing a lot of polyomino tile laying, which is my biggest love in gaming. So that's kind of what brought me there. And then from there, thought to myself, I need all of his games. And so now it's just this... very long process of acquiring every single game that he's ever created. Some are loves, some I think will maybe sit on the shelf a little bit longer, but for the most part, those big box games really hit with me. And Feast is kind of, I don't want to call it a perfect design, but pretty close to it for me.
Oh, strong feelings there. No, that's great to hear. I guess I'll just say, for my own sake, I'm a bit of a lapsed Uwe gamer fan, or maybe I'm an old grump or something like that. So my history is more intimate with his older games. So Agricola is one of those. I don't even know if it was the first Uwe game I played. It might have been Le Havre. Le Havre was kind of foisted on me by the game grognards in the group I played with at that time. And my theory is that there's no way to play that game without losing three times, right? Yeah. There's no way to play the first time without losing three times in that game. And it's very much like that. It's got this steep curve. And similarly, Agricola, I think maybe that would have been the second of his games that I played, also has a fairly steep curve.
It's the Dark Souls of board gaming. Prepare to starve.
Right. And genetically related to Caverna, right? Like Caverna's kind of like the follow-up to Agricola. And then we played Caverna for one of our episodes last season, perhaps. So I only really started playing that recently. And I've played kind of no other Uwe games in the intervening time. And I don't know why it is. It's not like I hate him or anything, but I guess, I don't know, maybe none of the newer themes have grabbed me.
Making a lot of lighter games lately, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so he's got a huge spread. Honestly, one of my second favorite games is Bonanza, which is just a card game.
Oh, that's true, yeah. I love
Bonanza. Yeah, that one... Yeah, Bonanza, genius. Like, it is very much just you are...
Yeah, his first breakout game.
You've got a huge spread with his games. He went through the tile laying phase where we ended up with Cottage Garden, Indian Summer, and then
Patchwork.
The third one.
That was Patchwork him too, yeah. All right.
Patchwork was the original one, I feel like, with tile laying. And that one also... I play on my phone daily, probably multiple times a day. I'm just bored. I'm going to play it against the computer. He's
New York Zoo, I think, was one of his most recent ones.
Oh, yeah. That one through Capstone that he created. That one's also, yeah. You would. I regularly think to myself, at what point has he exhausted all of his options for tile laying or for the card management that you end up with, like Agricola style. And it seems like he continually pushes out something new that makes me go, well, this is interesting enough and I need to play it.
You can kind of see an evolution chain from Feast for Odin to those more recent games and distilling that tile laying down into more elegant, simpler design. So yeah, it's been fascinating to follow that. But I guess I don't want to jump too far ahead. So for my, we need to cover Caverna recently, well, last year. And as I'm sure I described there, it wasn't love at first sight for me. I did have to learn to love Uwe's games after a couple of early experiences. And I'll blame the teach on that. But they're definitely a little intimidating. I did learn to love Caverna for what it's worth. I love just putting the... Just one of those games that even when you're playing badly, there's just that tactile joy of the putting your cows into your little farm and growing your carrots and very toyetic feel. So you always feel like you've got something to show for it.
That is a very good way of describing that, of just the being able to enjoy laying tiles on your own board and being able to do this experience by yourself. It is, most of his games are typically, you don't know who's winning until the end, which I very much enjoy. I'm not looking at somebody else's board and thinking, like, oh God, it's a race. I need to be doing this or that or the other. It's very much just like, what do I feel like doing today?
And if you happen to win, so be it.
Very nice. All right, let's do a quick overview of Feast for Odin. Olivia, we generally do a kind of like, I'm just going to give like the basic stats and maybe you can tell us a bit like overall how it shakes out. So the designers, Uwe Rosenberg, of course, artist and regular repeat artist, right? Dennis Lohausen. And publisher is Feuerland Spiele. Perhaps in Germany, maybe different in your country.
They were the publisher in English, so I'm sure there's a lot of different. There are other localized publishers.
So many.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And we might touch upon Norwegians, which was co-designed by Gernot Kopke. So there's the basics. But Olivia, do you want to tell us about kind of like genre and some of the core mechanisms of a Feast for Odin?
So at its heart, it's very much a worker placement polyomino game, but it additionally brings in like push your luck mechanics with some dice rolling. You've got two different dice that you can roll that do different things. There's resource management in the ways that you are trying to gain resources to either build boats, build sheds, things like that. And there's that typical Uwe card playing mechanic, which I cannot define, but feels so very typically him, in which you start the game with a card and you can pull cards throughout the game. And those just give you additional constant bonuses or, you know, something that you can do immediately. It's not as heavy as like Agricola, where it really relies on that card mechanic. Right. It's mostly just, it feels like it just needs to be in there because that is the way that he does it. So yeah, what you're doing in the game is you're sending your Vikings out on the main board, and you're raiding, hunting, exploring new territories, managing livestock, crafting goods, and tons of other things. It's very much a sandbox game with endless pathways to victory. And like, I truly, truly mean that. I have seen folks going, winning hard on just like emigration. I've seen folks win just taking the livestock route. I've seen them just exploring a ton of territories. Like there are endless possibilities to win this game. And you can kind of choose which way you want to play the game. So yeah, in the game, you start with like a ton of negative points on your main board, and you're working to cover those up with the tiles that you're gaining through that worker placement system. And then you can also gain additional player boards by exploring these islands that the Vikings explored in that time and raided and pillaged and all of that. So it's got a very... It's not like historically accurate at times, because we discussed that a lot in my friend group, but it does come with an almanac as well that you can read to kind of look over some of these towns and villages that you're actually going to, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I meant to read through that almanac. I own a copy, unfortunately, so I wasn't able to look through that. But I was very curious how the framing of that historical context is, because I studied some sort of archaeology of Viking culture and how they were not a monolith. Obviously, there were so many different Viking communities evolving over time. Many were peaceful traders and farmers. Some were violent raiders. Like, there was a wide spectrum of Viking culture, and I've forgotten a lot of that personally. This was like 15 years ago that I have not used that arts degree at all. So, but I think this game does do a good representation of that diversity. It's not, Vikings can be many different things, and you can focus on many different strategies in this game, obviously.
It's cool that a couple of those locations are the islands that you visit are actually parts of modern day Canada.
Labrador, yep. I think, is one of the islands. Yep. Yeah,
Labrador, Baffin Island, I think Newfoundland is in there as well. So that's cool to hear from our perspective. And I think you touched upon a really salient point there, Olivia, about how you start off in the negative, and that can be kind of daunting, I guess.
In debt. Congratulations.
In debt, sure, to most players. But, you know, that's actually... an aspect I really like about this game is that even though there is an arc to this game, a strong arc, you largely know what you have to do. You largely know what you have to accomplish from like turn one. And I was mentioning his earlier games, Agricola and Le Havre earlier, and I feel like you just can't know where to go from the start. Like, especially as a novice gamer, I'm just putting my foot in the novice gamer camp, because I'm relatively new to A Feast for Odin. I've only really seriously started playing in the last month or so. Played a couple times I bounced off it. I'll admit, I bounced off it my previous attempts. So I'm just really latching on. But I like how you know your trajectory in this game. You know you're supposed to fill those negatives, and that gives you something strong to build towards. And you also know what all the actions are right away, unlike Agricola or Le Havre. So I noticed that was a really distinct difference in this design versus his earlier ones, and I thought maybe we can touch upon that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really solid point to just... the fact that you immediately know what you need to do, which is to get those tiles to cover up those negative points on your player board. There are some restrictions based on the color of the tiles. There's a unique mechanic in the game in which the tiles are double-sided. Each has a different color, and then they have, I guess, a partner in which you upgrade to another color. And the more upgrades you get, the better it is to place on your board, or the easier it is to put them next to other tiles with those restrictions. So then actually learning the game.
Advance these.
Yeah. That's a great way to explain it. It's a tech tree. And so like, you know, you've got to get these things and you know the restrictions starting off the bat. And now you've got this huge main board where you're doing the worker placement and you're going, how do I do this? And you're learning by actually playing the game. It took me, I think the first game that I played, the scores were like in between 30 points and 49 points. That was our first game with my friend group. From there, we're now into the 100 plus points. So it took some time to get used to.
Yeah, for all of the dauntingness of that debt, I don't think I've ever seen anyone end the game with negative points. So I'm sure it's certainly possible. maybe my previous game years ago when I first played this. But it is a very clear goal. You get your first player board, it's got those negative points, and you've got that clear initial goal, fill this up. And you can focus on the big brain strategy of just get big tiles, fill the big board with your big tiles, easy. But then as you get more familiar with the game, you see these very player-driven goals of, maybe I can fill out one more board, maybe I can get one more island. And it's very player-driven to how much you want to push that, like judging your debt and when you think you can take on extra load. And so, yeah, very much an efficiency puzzle, I guess, in terms of it's hard to judge that pacing-wise, at what point can you take on more point debt.
Right. And so one of those, one half of that point is that you know what you're doing from the outset. But one of the things that I found really daunting as a novice player was the sheer amount of actions that are available to you. Unlike Agricola, where there's only like 10, in this game, there's like 60.
65? Turn one.
So I think a lot of people have talked about that. That's probably the number one thing people say when you hear Feast for One is like, whoa, I can't touch that. I can't touch those 60 actions all at once. But there's a design language to it, right? So, Olivia, maybe you can touch upon like what are the types of actions and how do they basically break down?
Yeah. So like in that, when you're looking at the main board, it is broken up into sections. And you can see that on the farthest left side of the board, it'll actually go through and say like what the range of what you're doing, right? Like, are you hunting? There's a couple of rows where you can hunt. Are you trying to purchase livestock? That's the livestock market. So it's kind of giving you an idea of what exactly they are and how many options you have within that. But making it a little bit more difficult is, the columns give you more as you build out to the right. But the more that it gives you, the more workers you need to place down. So your first option is to place down one worker. That's not going to give you a lot, but it'll give you something. And so you only start with a set number of workers each round. For me, it was incredibly daunting to look at the first time that I witnessed that board. And also a good point to bring up too with this is I strictly now play with the Norwegians expansion, which gives you a slightly different board as well than like the base game, because it gives you like an additional option for your last play of the round. It's one of those games that it feels very difficult to teach properly because it is a sandbox game and because it very much is like, you've just got to try it out. You've just got to go put your workers on that space, see what it gives you, see how you can upgrade the items that you get, whether it's you're hunting and you're getting these big tiles that are meat or pelts and what you can turn that into.
Here's five workers and a sword. Now go explore this board.
Yeah,
it can feel like that sometimes. Like you called Caverna a sandbox game earlier. Oh, sorry, you called this a sandbox game, right? Like Caverna was definitely a sandbox. But I think this is the whole beach. Like it's just so much sand everywhere, and it is incredibly daunting, especially someone like me who has a lot of analysis paralysis and can struggle to form my own goals. Like I regularly need a little bit of guidance. And you do get that starting occupation card, which can give you a little bit of a nudge. You can pick up some more as the game goes on, but you largely have to decide for yourself what are you going to focus on.
Yeah, I like how you were starting to describe like the kind of types of groups. And if you break it down that way, there's kind of like five or six key sort of activities you can do. Yeah. And there's like 10 ways to do each of those kind of activities and how they break down on the board. So like one of them is like building these buildings, which you may choose to fill. Some of them are like building these boats, which you may use to do things. And then there's like the food producing kind of two areas. So there's kind of like vegetable matter, and then there's animals, ranching, I suppose. And then there's, I guess the rest of it I would call, other than getting islands, is kind of filling up your board and getting erasing your negatives.
Yeah.
And if you kind of break it down into those four or five groups, like that's how I eventually had to come to it, is like, I know I have to fill up those board spaces. How am I going to do it? Here's like kind of 10 different ways you could do it. Or I know I need food next turn. Here are 10 actions that can kind of get me food. I think if you use that heuristic coming into it, it's a little bit less daunting. Hopefully for new players out there who might be trying to tackle it.
I mean, it is laid out very logically. I will say that it can feel a bit like a spreadsheet, like doing your taxes of getting Viking loot. And it's very logical in terms of, like, as you said, the columns of both the categories and the subsequent number of meeples you require. I did struggle a little bit in terms of, it's not very thematic. There's not a lot of hooks to visualize how these are laid out. It's logical, but not immersive to really wrap your head around in that sense, which I sometimes need a little bit more of.
I felt that this game is very thematic as far as an Uwe game is concerned. maybe more so like Agricola is very thematic. Like you're a farmer subsisting and struggling. And in this one, all the activities you can do, you could farm, you can raid, you can explore, you can loot. Like those things are exciting, like way more exciting than a lot of things you can do in a lot of other Uwe games. So in that sense, I found it to be pretty thematic.
Also, not even the actions that aren't thematic, just the layout and how they're organized. Sure. Like you think of something like Architects of the West Kingdom, I was thinking of, which has a lot fewer spaces, obviously, but like you've got the forest where you go and do your woodwork and the mines where you go and get your stone. Yeah. And so it's just easier to visualize.
Like the graphic design is not very thematic. Yeah.
The logical just doesn't bring you in.
Very cool.
Yeah, Olivia, that German design. Yeah, no, I was gonna say, like, I understand, like, there's the theme for me hits on that main player board, and then you kind of lose it when you're like, and now I'm taking all of these things and just putting them onto my board. That's a little bit where you might like lose the this action doesn't make sense. I'm putting meats right next to like a horn, a drinking horn, or a pelt, or something that like I is it smelting? I forget, crafted, whatever it is that you can do on there.
There's an English crown in there somewhere that they've forgotten about.
I know what you mean.
Oh yeah,
there's like phases to it, right? Like it's the filling out your board is kind of like doing taxes at the end of the year. Like all the activities you might be doing during the year might be super exciting. Like I'm building a startup and like I'm risking my livelihood and I'm working with these new exciting people and doing new stuff. And then at the end of the year, I'm going to do my taxes and that's going to show the world how successful I am. It's like, it's a shift over to that side.
It like both fills me with joy and hurts my heart that you both are like, it's like doing taxes. And I'm like, but I hate doing taxes, but like equally, this is very much a spreadsheet to me. So I get it.
Board games, they contain multitudes, right?
Let's pivot a little bit. One thing I wanted to discuss about those player boards is that there is some interesting decisions to be made there. You're not just filling them out. There's a lot of little bonuses along the way. So there's most of them, both your starting board and some of the other islands you can get have these little bonus squares where if you completely surround them, you get like an income, like you get an extra horn or a runestone each turn. And you can just cover those over and move on and try and fill up the space, or you can be very tricky in sort of getting just the right shape to surround it to get that bonus. And so that provides a really juicy decision as to whether you're just going to fill up your board quickly to get like income, because there's also income spaces to cover up, or are you going to get the smaller tricky bits to cover up your to get those bonuses?
I think that's the trickiest thing for new players as well. I'll definitely state that, because the key to getting more points and actually kind of almost building, it's not really building an engine, but being able to get that on your income phase every round is discovering new islands or bringing in those sheds to then get all of those tiles every single round and be able to upgrade those tiles to then place them down. But as a new player, you're looking at it again as those negative points. So you've got on your player board, it specifically shows you, it's like 120, 21 negative points or something. So it'll say that number in the top right corner. And then with all of the islands and all of the sheds, it's also going to tell you that. So I think there is a point at which you feel a little bit scared of, oh my God, all of these negative points, I've only got four more rounds. I could never. But it's kind of the key to really building up more during your profit off of it all.
Yeah, and there really is a sense of escalation. You get an extra worker each turn for one thing, and there are those small ways in which you can eke out a little bit of an advantage, whether it's the incoming gold, because gold is so versatile. You can spend gold for various action points. You can use gold to just buy boats rather than using an action. You can use gold to just put it on the board. You can go, like, the literal pieces can be placed on the board to fill out spaces and help get more bonuses, and that can cascade in some really interesting ways. But it's very hard to get a sense of that scope on your first play, for sure.
And you could feed your people that gold too if you need to plop it in their feast board as well.
I like to say that we're just plopping in a silver coin in somebody's mouth and like, there you go, you're fed, thanks.
There you go. It's like, I might go hungry, but I'm liking this this meal right now. No, that's great. Yeah, I like how that this is so streamlined compared to a lot of the earlier Uwe games. It's like you had to play a card to build up your engine. Well, in this case, it's on the board. If you surround these spaces, you earn this thing in future rounds. That's very streamlined. In A Feast for Odin, you gain a worker every round. You don't have to go to the baby-making space or building a new room for them. That's really, really efficient. So, like, you, no one feels left behind if they didn't draft just the right card, you know? Mm. So that part of it is a lot more well-balanced. And if you're struggling as an early player, you can look toward your neighbors and seeing what they're doing and be like, oh, yep. I get it. I can build towards this. It's not just a daunting threat to your player board. It's kind of a series of opportunities, right? So I would say that probably the Tetrising was the thing that drew me into this game and that keeps me engaged, is that, like, that tactile puzzle, right? You were saying about Caverna. Like, this game has a tactility of its own, is the Tetris game. I like that a lot.
Especially like green tiles can't touch other green tiles. So you have to sort of intersperse them in just the right way.
That's Blockus. That's Blockus right there.
I will say that element of the game does, it's less interesting the further the game goes on, because by the time you start filling out the board, then you just get to those huge swaths of the minus one point. So then you just get the biggest spot, get the biggest tile, fill it in. You don't really have that balance of the bonuses and getting the right shapes at that end. So I think that part is most interesting at the start. Or if you grab the islands, and because those are more unique shapes and lots of like weird corners to try and fill in. So I think once you've mastered the basics, getting those islands is certainly the more exciting part of playing that little Tetris mini game.
Yeah, the player boards are a little bit restricted in that sense because they really don't give you a ton, and you really have to build upwards and outwards while you're doing it to get more income. So getting, again, like the sheds or the islands, those are a little bit less restrictive and will allow you to then get more of those resources as you go throughout the game. I also think another good thing for new players is they do have some options where, like for hunting, if you don't walk away successful in your hunt. You get things in return. So you might get more wood. You might get another bow and arrow. Or there's a space where you lay a snare and you get a worker back if you don't successfully lay that snare, which I usually push people towards that. I'm like, why don't you try hunting? This at least doesn't feel so bad that like you've lost and you get nothing. You know, like you're at least walking away with something out of it all.
Yeah, you're always getting something in this game. For all of that debt overhead, it's not particularly punished. It's a very generous game. Like, it's giving you a free worker every turn. It's giving you this bounty of food every couple of turns. And even when you fail a dice roll, you're getting something out of it. So you always have something to show. It's you never feel like you've wasted a turn entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you touched upon a couple of points there, Olivia. I wanted to follow up on is, you've played this game a lot. Do you feel like there are any kind of like dominant strategies or strong strategies that players in your experience go towards? Like you mentioned, like the islands. Islands, I would think, I haven't played this game a lot. I've played it like six times or something like that. I would think that the islands would become a very strong point of contention for certain high level gamers. And maybe you have some other suggestions for like dominant strategies this might potentially have.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying my friends created a Viking convention that we've been doing. This will be the seventh year because of A Feast for Odin. And we've got one friend specifically who wins a lot. He's very good at this. He plays it solo all the time. And we've started putting restrictions on him where we've said you can only purchase lives or you can only choose livestock. You can't go to the islands. And I have seen him win still over all of these restrictions. For me, I always say just do what feels very good. So I like to emigrate a lot. I like to get boats ahead of time, emigrate very quickly, because that allows you to not feed as many people as you're doing it. But I haven't seen the most that I've seen as a strategy to follow is really getting those islands. I really enjoy they have a mechanic in which if most of the islands weren't chosen, or like whatever islands weren't chosen that round, you place silver on there to pick up every single time if you choose it later on in the rounds. I forget where that plays out on your player board. So you could end up getting an island with a ton of silver on it and put that on that island already and be able to get something special for yourself almost immediately. I've always felt very intimidated by the islands, despite that being really a good way to go. And yet I'm still like, I don't know. I win a lot in our two-player games with my partner and I. It's pretty split 50-50. And we might choose different paths each time. Like pillaging and raiding is really, really nice. I find that to be pretty easy because you're just going at it with a boat. There's so many options. That said, we play with the Norwegians expansion, which I find almost at this point, I have to play with that. And there's also a mini expansion that adds a few extra things to it as well that I really enjoy playing with. So the Norwegians expansion is the biggest expansion. It provides a totally new board. Again, you've got on the right side of the board, you've got this option for your last turn to get something like extra special, extra sweet. And so it doesn't feel like you're just kind of throwing away that last turn. Play with that?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That last turn, often you end up with just one or two meeples left over, which really feels like dregs. Like, well, I may as well just get some fish or something, right? So that adds a really extra juicy final, like a little capper to your turn. Like, oh, I can get something, a bonus out of it, but it has to be your last action. So there's any more powerful versions of the actions that require one or two meeples. And I think if you play two of them, you get to play a free occupation as well, which is often very hard to do.
I really like that change in Norwegians. I've only played it the one time at Daniel's place recently, but I think it adds a lot of necessary tension or wanted tension to the worker placement, because I like worker placement games. I played them from the early days on to now, but they can tend to be a bit dry at times, especially if you play the game a lot. In this game, you're playing a sort of like game of chicken, right? Is to see, like, I really want to do that as my last action, but is Daniel going to take it away from me?
Yeah.
You have to like fight that internal battle to see what's more important to you at the time. So really like that a lot. And also how they execute the card acquisition and the card play is slightly different in Norwegians as well. I like that shift.
Yeah, and it also gives balance to player count, right? Because like it's a modular board. It's not just one big board that's the same for all player counts. It's like three sections that flip based on the number of players. So it really does rebalance things based on how many players you have and expands the number of options. So I think that's a lot more dynamic.
They've definitely added more sand to the beach, essentially, because you've got that player board with different options. They've also got starter artisan sheds, which is really nice. So instead of just playing with your player board, you've now got this shed that you can create and then start working with.
It's a little nudge, a little suggestion of what you might want to focus on.
Yeah. More suggestions. They've got the VP tokens as well. So if you don't, because I don't particularly like playing the cards too much, or like I end up with cards that I hate and that aren't even worth that many victory points. So it is nice to be able to play a card and just get a victory point, or get, you know, like the highest amount of victory points off of a crappy card that you don't really like. Because those cards aren't, they're not the main part of the game. It's kind of just like an added bonus of getting those cards and getting to play them.
Yeah,
a special sauce.
Like some of, a special sauce. It's kind of a, so some of them, if you're, some of them that you pull, it's like, I could have used this three rounds ago. This stinks for me now. Being able to like add the victory points instead is a really nice mechanic. The Norwegians expansion to me is necessary at this point to play the game, because it just
it feels like a bit of a 2.0 to the game. Right? It's not really an expansion. Yeah. It just recontextualizes a lot of the game. It doesn't add a lot of new stuff. Just recalculates and rebalances a lot of little things.
Yeah.
And they've got a couple of other mini expansions.
Hmm.
They've got a couple of other mini expansions that either add like additional territories and islands. There's like Christmas tiles that you can pillage. But there's a second mini expansion that I also play with that adds a 1x1 tile crop. I believe they're berries. Mm. And then randomized harvest tokens. So instead of doing every other harvest, you randomize it each time. Which equally, that I would say, don't play that as a novice. You know, play that once you've been playing the game for a bit.
Interestingly, those actually come with the base game now. My friend just got, like, it's been out of print for quite a while. And he's had it on pre-order for like over a year. It came in and it included those mini expansions, the harvests and the little one tiles, which is like an income.
Good.
Which is like, you get an extra income each round. And then that did stop it from, it takes away one more deterministic element from this game. Because I can see, like, if you're going to focus on emigration or focus on animals, that's largely going to look the same each game. I think you have to force yourself to pivot and change, focus on something else sometimes. So I think that harvest can also shake things up and force you to explore other parts of the board, perhaps. And the same with the occupations. I think that's what occupations at their best, just especially if you get them early, can encourage you to just go out of your way to try something different. But by the end of the game, it's largely like, well, is this perfect for my strategy, or should I just discard it, right? So lots of little ways to just force you to recalculate the value of particular action spaces.
Very nice. So I feel like we've covered a lot of ground here, and I could also talk forever about Uwe Rosenberg games and the Feast for Odin, but I feel like we got a good meal out of this feast, which you like to joke about food all the time on the Gamers Club podcast. But maybe we can wrap it up with like a final thought there. I can go, and Daniel can go, and Olivia, you can give us your final thought on Feast, if that's okay. I'll start. Just for myself, I'll say that I already gave you my history about Uwe Rosenberg games. Agricola, I love. Le Havre, I love. The latter day games of his oeuvre, I haven't loved so much. But this game has really kind of captured me in the intensive month, last month or so of play that I've had. It was really great to play it in person with Daniel, with the Norwegians expansion. That kind of made it all the more exciting. And it's fantastic that this game's on Board Game Arena. So even if you don't own a copy, you can go check it out with your friends, maybe get them to teach you first, because it's a hard game to sort of get into. But also, it's got a great solo mode, and Uwe games have great solo modes. So you can definitely try that out on your own on Board Game Arena. There's no stress, just playing against yourself. So I think this is climbing up the ranks for me. This might be my number two, or maybe even potentially my number one Uwe.
Very cool.
Time will tell.
To hear it.
As you hinted in Feast there, I do have a point of bias against this game in that my personal channel, Board Game Feast, this game is like my enemy in terms of SEO. search Board Game Feast, and it always gives you a feast for Odin.
A feast for Daniel.
I've hinted a few times that I've struggled with this game. Partly, I mean, I've learnt to love Agricola. I've learnt to love Caverna. This one I am still struggling with a little bit. And all the things I say against this in terms of its intimidation, obviously not a qualitative statement. The analogy I really like is Lego. It's been useful in a lot of games. Like, do you prefer the big box of 1,000 pieces of Lego that lets you build whatever you want? Or do you prefer the kit that's going to let you build a spaceship and nothing else? and both of those are completely valid. I personally prefer the latter. I prefer a little more guidance, a little more railroading. So Caverna, I think, does a better job of that. Even though Caverna is very open-ended, it tutorializes and the actions a little more. Like, you start out with 5 actions, and then they expand over the course of the game. So a little more focus there. And again, you've still got that really toyetic element of playing with your cows, right? This doesn't quite have that hook for me. So I'm still struggling to find that benefit. The occupations never really go far enough to give you that guidance. The artisan sheds go a little bit of the way there, but otherwise I'm still largely drowning a little bit in this sea of action spaces. So not that it's bad. Again, obviously very much a preferential thing, but I prefer the more focused element of Caverna, I think.
Great. Yeah, totally. Olivia, you want to give us your thoughts on A Feast? I'll think you might like it.
The opposite side.
Yeah.
I love it. Playing it since it came out. I think the biggest thing for me, again, is very much that sandbox. I haven't found a lot of games that fit a really well thought out sandbox to explore in. I usually feel like when I end up in a game that's described as kind of sandboxy, I still feel like I am being kind of pushed in one direction or the other. This has truly felt like the only game for me that really fits in. Take whatever route you want, try something new this game. You're not going to completely flop. You are going to end up with similar scores that you have in the past. And I've watched myself grown over the years, getting better and better at it, which I think feels very good for the amount of plays that I've gotten in it. It doesn't feel like a game that, you know, you play 10 times, you figured it out, you figured out how to play against each of your friends, you know how to play against them and you know how to win against them or something. It definitely hit the sweet spot for me. And I will say that I used you two just a little bit to try and again beg that we get the next expansion, which is the Danes expansion. It was announced years ago. It was announced years ago and I still have no word on it. And so, like, please, please, somebody figure it out for me. Please, someone get me that. I will take it.
Give us the Danes. That that's where just are the Danes?
Add more love to it. Yeah. Where are the Danes? I was told so this year, but I don't know.
I've been looking on Board Game Geek, and Gurno has been very active on there. It's a couple of interesting essays talking about, like, the Viking culture and some of the designers. A lot of design diaries on there, basically. But I saw one from last month from him basically saying that the Danes is now a standalone game. It's no longer an expansion. But expected latter half of 2025, I think.
Maybe it's compatible.
You just got to
never
watch
know.
Real time.
It's conflicting reactions. Conflicting Whoa. Reports on what it's going to be. But it's from what it originally was supposed to be, very ambitious, like unique player boards, which is something that's probably most interesting to me. Reshaking the occupations. A lot of things going on there. There's a huge list of what thoughts are going into that. But yeah, it's been in the works since like 2018, which is wild.
Forever. And I feel like I talk about it a lot, and I'm like, I would just like it. Standalone is okay though too, because honestly, compared to a lot of other Viking games, we get a lot of like the, you know, Champions of Midgard, Raiders of the North Sea. You get a lot of just like, we're raiding, we're pillaging. And I really like to farm. I like to just sit on my farm, get my cows, and just chill out.
Nice.
Very, very bloodless. Even when you're raiding in this game, it's a very bloodless Viking experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm choosing to be optimistic. Sounds like this potentially standalone expansion could be a new, cool iteration, evolution of this kind of system that Uwe and company have been working on for a while. I'm positive towards some of these newer designs. I'm not a grumpy old man. No, this is great. It's always great to learn new stuff. Well, and it was fantastic to meet you, Olivia. It was a real pleasure talking to you, sensing your passion about this game. Obviously, you got a wealth of experience and in the opinions that you gave, so I really appreciate it, you coming on board.
Yes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you both for having me on.
Of course. Yeah, and you had some exciting stuff happening locally. I think you're not in your home, actually, for this recording?
No, electricity went out at 1 a.m. today. And we're also under heat advisory. So I'm in a friend's house with wonderful air conditioning. I forgot to mention the Viking convention that my friends hold every year. We have a Jarl at the end of it all. And so I am in this year's Jarl's house. So thank you, Frank. I really appreciate it.
So thank you for going out of your way to join us. But it's very, very relevant being in, talking about Feast for Odin in the Jarl's house. There you go.
Absolutely. On that subject, what's the name of the con? What's the name of your local con?
It started out as a group of, I think, like six of us. And a friend of ours, I love her very dearly, surprised everybody at the end of this week. Right. It was just a weekend of like, we're going to play Viking games. These are like 4 hour long games. Let's sit down and play them. And our friend surprised us, and she made trophies for everybody who was the winner of each game. Again, somebody was the Jarl. Someone was whoever lost the hardest got a trophy. Since then, we've created it's 7 years now. It has morphed into everybody making it their own. So whoever is the Jarl kind of decides what we're doing that year. We've made like cardboard shields, painted minis. We've crafted wooden longboats and actually like sailed them out on a little pond to see whose could float the best. Truly all of that was because of A Feast for Odin. We loved the game so much. We were having difficulty getting friends to sit down for that long to play it that we were like, it's Memorial Day weekend. Let's just play this game. So thanks, Uwe. I appreciate it.
That's so great. We definitely chose the right guest to join us for this episode then. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about how people can follow you, what you're working on professionally and game-wise? How can people reach out to you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram, on Twitter, at same username, at oloplays. As well as all of the other social media pages that we're all attempting to get on, but, you know, isn't quite taking off. I work with Flat River Group. I work with about like 40 to 50 publishers, helping them within our organization, mostly distribution. but I love it. And a lot of playtesting is the other thing that I really like to do with my publishers, because any way that I can kind of be part of the process or spread my what education I've received really fills me with a lot of joy. So you can find me on social media. I don't have any plugs. I'm buying a house soon. So if anybody's got any tips on buying, like dealing with house stuff, help me out with that.
We'll send you good house buying energy here.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's so great. Well, I hope you'll please, and this is honestly, I hope you'll please let us know if there's anything we can help you with in the future. If there's any news you want to get out there in the world, need someone to help playtesting, just reach out to me and Daniel, and we can put the word out to our audience and help in any way we can.
Thank you. And again, thank you so much for having me on. This was a joy.
Yes, no, it's great to see someone with such passion for a particular game.
Absolutely. All right, let's announce the game we're going to be playing on our next episode. Daniel, we just decided, what is that game going to be?
Yeah, so we're going to take a look at the video game Chants of Sanaa. That's Chants, C-H-A-N-T-S. So I don't know much about this yet. I know it's a puzzly game based around languages and sort of language structure. Mark, I know you've started.
I've been watching my partner play this one. It's both beautiful, and the puzzle within it is making you think in a way that I've never thought before, because it is like a made up language that like you don't know you as the character, you as the person. I'm just excited to hear you both play it because it's beautiful.
Great. Well, let us know what you think as you continue to watch it play.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic intro, Olivia. Yeah. I'll just say, just started. It's kind of got its hooks in me, so I will save my thoughts for the future episode. It's very cool, though. It just hit Xbox Game Pass, so anyone who's subscribed, go check it out. There's nothing stopping you. And a good indie game that people should support if you want to drop the cash to.
Yes. So if you have any questions or comments on Feast for Odin or Chants of Sanaa or any other games, you can contact us and join the club at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can follow Daniel at Board Game Feast, myself at Omnigamer Mark, Olivia at Olo Plays. And please tune in. You can watch us on YouTube. We're posting videos, including this episode, on a weekly basis. So you can catch us there if you haven't caught us on that platform yet. And I want to thank Olivia one more time. You brought amazing energy to this episode. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Awesome. And I guess until next time, everyone out there, I hope you have a balanced diet of gaming.
Only one stack of beans.
There you go. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Eat that silver.